This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last week, three professional storm chasers were among the 19 people who died in the tornadoes and the subsequent flooding that hit the Oklahoma City area. 55-year-old Tim Samaras, the founder of the tornado research project called TwistX, died. Also, his 24-year-old son, Paul, and their chase partner, 45-year-old Carl Young. All three were killed after they were overtaken by a multiple vortex tornado that sharply changed direction. Joining me now, Bill Gallus, a professor in Iowa State University's Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences. Bill Gallus, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Bill, and I understand you were a close friend of Tim Samaras. He worked with him many times. I'm very sorry for your loss.
I appreciate that.
Bill, I wonder, to begin, can you tell us a little bit about Tim Samaras and his work, and your work with him?
We first connected with Tim because in the early 2000s, we had just gotten our tornado simulator working at Iowa State, and one of the first things we needed to do was get some real data from inside tornadoes to compare to the measurements we could take inside our lab one, just to prove that it was realistic. And at that point in time, it appeared the only person in the world that was able to get data inside tornadoes was Tim. He had just had a successful deployment of an instrument in the path of an F4 tornado in South Dakota, which measured the world record drop in pressure. So we invited him to come to the simulator, and I recall ironically being rather nervous, thinking that Tim was going to laugh or find our simulator, you know, wrong in many ways, find many faults with it. But instead, I remember that once we started the dry ice into it so you could see the tornado, he got this smile like a kid in a candy store and just started telling us how it looked exactly like, you know, this one tornado or this other tornado. In addition, he had that instrument probe with him that had measured that world record drop, and he right away asked if he could put it on our platform in the path of our simulated tornado. And my colleague and I looked at each other and said, oh, we don't think it's going to show anything. You probably shouldn't bother. But Tim pretty much just ignored us and put it in the path of the tornado, and sure enough, it measured a pressure trace that looked almost like a carbon copy of the one in from South Dakota, except with things being much smaller in scale.
Uh-huh. How small? Because I'm trying to picture this in a laboratory.
So the simulator resides in a part of a building on the Iowa State campus that looks kind of like a warehouse. And so the simulator itself is, I would guess, about roughly 20 feet wide. And so it can create a tornado that might be as wide as 4 to 6 feet.
Mm.
So we're talking about, let's say a 5-foot-wide tornado versus, I think, the South Dakota tornado may have been 2,000 or 3,000 feet wide.
What is your understanding of what happened last Friday in that horrible tornado, the largest, the widest tornado on record? I want to talk about that fact in a minute, but what is your understanding of how these three experienced storm chasers were caught?
At first, I think it's safe to say the entire community could not believe that this could happen. When the news first started coming out, people were assuming that this was inaccurate and, that these were rumors and were waiting for more authoritative sources to even believe it. And the reason is they felt that, these guys were as good as anybody at planning safety routes to get out of the way. Tim was extremely safety-minded, and I have many stories of things with our students that prove that. So at first, we all believed that there maybe were with car problems, perhaps a flat tire or something went wrong, and that's what prevented them from getting out of the way. Since then, with the surveys the National Weather Service has done, it sounded like this was among the most unusual behaviors of a tornado that has ever been documented. And it seems perhaps they were just caught, like so many storm chasers, with something that had never been seen before, which prevented them from getting out of the way. The tornado suddenly expanded from 1 mile to the record 2.6 miles wide in the space of about 30 seconds. And when it did so, it changed its direction of movement by 120 degrees. So from what I've heard, there were suction vortices or sort of mini tornadoes that were being flung around the main tornado at 170 or 180 miles per hour. And some of the other storm chasers who got out of the way in the nick of time, many of them thought they were going to die. There were at least two or three other cars that were tossed. And they said it was, you went from being 3 miles away, which is normally an ideal distance to witness a tornado, to feeling like the tornado was just rapidly coming upon you, and you couldn't get out of the way, even going 80 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just possible that, yeah, this sort of worst-case scenario happened when all of the best laid plans that they always used to ensure safety would end up failing.
It swelled from 1 mile to 2.6 miles wide in a 30-second span. As someone who understands atmospheric sciences, Bill Gallus, what is going on to cause that in the atmosphere?
You know, I don't think we know totally. I've had former students, you know, contacting me, you know, shaken up, and who've chased tornadoes and want to know, well, how can we know when something like this would happen again? Because obviously nobody would want to get close to that tornado. One thing that was a bit more unusual last Friday was the atmosphere was extremely unstable in Oklahoma, which, you know, allows thunderstorm clouds to erupt in a fashion very similar to an atomic bomb blast. And the winds were strong enough to get tornadoes. You need to have pretty strong winds and good changes in the wind speed and direction, which we call wind shear. You had enough of that on Friday, but it wasn't overly strong. And you know, my speculation would be, you know, because the thunderstorms were able to be so powerful that they were able to kind of, you know, fling the tornadoes around or cause weird things to be going on with the tornadoes, since you didn't have, you know, such strong winds to help steer the things in fairly normal, you know, straight line.
I understand. Initially, though, that tornado, that monster tornado, was initially rated at an EF3, but then upgraded by the National Weather Service to an EF5, the top of the scale. And I understand that on average, only one out of every 1,000 tornadoes that hit the U.S. each year would be that top rating. There have only been 8 F5 or EF5 tornadoes in Oklahoma since 1950, two of them in the past 2 weeks, the one that hit on May 20th and the one from last Friday. Any idea in your circles as to why Oklahoma City area is getting so many violent storms this year?
You know, if you've been in Iowa this spring, you know, we had rather strange, sort of annoying weather, especially getting that snow in early May. And the jet stream has been pushed really far south, which caused a lot of cold, wet weather in Iowa. So during these last few weeks, the core of the jet stream, the strongest winds, has been pretty much right over Oklahoma. And we were able to get some wiggles in the jet stream that helped to form low-pressure centers that help lift the air. And so the very best ingredients for tornadoes have just happened to occur over central Oklahoma, you know, producing these two EF5 tornadoes.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, Bill Gallus is my guest, a professor in Iowa State University's Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences. He was a friend of Tim Samaras, one of the three storm chasers, professional storm chasers, who died last Friday in a tornado in Oklahoma. Had you ever spoken with Tim about the risk involved in storm chasing, Bill?
We had several long conversations, and ironically, I've chased tornadoes since the late 1980s. And, you know, after that initial visit of having Tim to our laboratory, we really liked him and realized that he was the person that would give us the best chance of getting the data we needed. And so as that relationship developed, and Tim mentioned needing a, you know, bunch of people to go out with him in the field, you know, I couldn't believe that I was facing what should have been a dream come true for me to get to chase with somebody that had such incredible encounters. But I actually found myself realizing I wasn't brave enough to be that close. And I remember joking with Tim and apologizing and say, well, you know, I'll see if there are students who want to do that, but I personally would be uncomfortable. And, you know, he was fully understanding of that. The other kind of funny story in this is when I went to tell the students about this opportunity, I made sure to stress that, you know, this would be dangerous. It's something I was choosing not to do because it was too close for my comfort. So I figured it might be hard to find a student team, but when I asked, well, how many people would want to be considered, it was every hand went up in the air. So I think the students knew what an incredible opportunity this would be, and they fully trusted Tim's skills.
Mm-hmm. You said, though, that you have had experience personally chasing storms.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any close calls?
I tend to be a very conservative tornado chaser. Generally, I see no reason to get any closer than about 2 miles away. That being said, the closest call I had was as part of a government research project where we made the mistake of chasing a tornado right as it was getting dark. It was approaching sunset, and we all knew that you really should never chase after dark. We just sort of didn't realize how quickly it would get dark once you ended up under the storm clouds. And, you know, that ironically was probably the one time in my life where I had access to the most weather data. I was with, at the time, somebody who had almost the same reputation as Tim Samaras, you know, had now. So, yes, I did have one or two close calls over those 20-some years.
Mm-hmm. Some people, Bill Gallus, may have a hard time imagining the appeal of such a profession, storm chasing. Help us understand what goes on in your mind. What is the thrill? What is the passion? Also the scientific appeal of it.
You know, I think people who enjoy the view from a mountaintop or like to climb, you know, find themselves drawn to maybe want to climb Mount Everest because it's really the most amazing mountain out there. If you have any interest at all in how the weather works, how the atmosphere works, I think you're drawn to want to see a tornado because the power. And there's actually a kind of beauty in what's going on inside a tornado, which might sound strange in light of, you know, the many of the tragedies that have happened. But when you witness a tornado, you're witnessing something that's almost impossible to describe. And I think, therefore, it's relatively normal for people with a passion for meteorology to want to see a tornado. And I think, you know, the more we understand about how the atmosphere works, we know that there are some locations where it's relatively safe to get, you know, position yourself and then watch a tornado from. Where we start to run into more problems is in recent years there seems to be this push to get the best video ever, the most exciting video. And so people have been getting closer and closer to the centers of the tornado. In addition, we've learned that to make improvements in building standards, we really do need some measurements from inside a tornado. And so people like Tim, you know, we're providing an extremely valuable service, creating instrument probes that they would put out right in front of the path of a tornado and then get out of the way. And so they also, unfortunately, had to get fairly close in to ensure that the probes would take data inside a tornado.
So there is unique scientific value in having storm chasers, things they can determine that cannot be determined in other less dangerous ways.
Yes, there's scientific value, especially from those chasers who've been able to put instruments in the path. You know, I know when I've chased, I haven't had the funds to purchase instruments, but tornadoes, I sometimes call tornadoes to my students the final frontier in meteorology. And what I mean by that is there's still a lot we don't understand. I mean, we still don't know why some thunderstorms may be spinning very strongly and don't produce a tornado at the ground. You know, other ones may not seem to have as much spin up in the cloud, but yet they produce a tornado at the ground. So when I'm on a tornado chase, I'm usually thinking of the many different theories that have been tossed out that explain why tornadoes form, and I'm trying to see just visually if the theories seem to be getting explained by what I'm witnessing. You know, does it seem to be matching what our beliefs are about how we get a tornado?
What is that specific scientific data that a storm chaser might be able to collect with a probe being right so close to the storm?
With the work that we've done at Iowa State, it's been primarily with the Aerospace Engineering Group, and so our desire is to know what the winds are doing near the ground. On a normal day, you know, we have a good idea of how the wind speed changes as you go from the ground upward. And so we know that the winds are usually blowing a lot more strongly the higher up you go from the ground. In a tornado, there have been some computer models that suggest the very worst winds might be at a height of only 15 feet above the ground. So we really strongly believe that the winds behave differently in a tornado. We need to know exactly what they're doing so that we can understand what forces impact structures so we can possibly change the way we build buildings to withstand tornadoes better. So obviously wind measurements are one thing we need, but that's very hard to do. Tornadoes tend to destroy most instruments that would measure wind. You know, Tim, his first instrument probes would measure pressure along with temperature and moisture. And if you have a good idea what the pressure field looks like, you could, you know, approximate the winds. In more recent years, he had created some ways of trying to get the wind measurements. In addition, when we worked with him, he had two different video probes. So each of these probes contains seven video cameras, you know, one looking up, the other six doing a 360-degree field of view. And the idea is if you could get footage from two probes, get some camera footage at the same time, you can do something called stereo photogrammetry, which allows you to track, you know, the little pieces of debris that are being blown around in the tornado and actually determine what the winds are doing. So that was a goal for several years with Tim. That goal proved very difficult. You know, Tim was successful on one tornado near Grand Island in getting the stereo photogrammetry data, but we then discovered the tornado was happening a little bit too close to sunset, and there really wasn't enough light to get accurate measurements of the speeds.
Bill Gallus is a professor in Iowa State University's Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences. Bill, you mentioned a few minutes ago the beauty of a tornado being hard to describe. I wonder if you could try, from your perspective, describe the beauty that you see in a tornado.
You know, tornadoes take on almost any kind of form imaginable. Here in Ames, we had a tornado in November 2005 that actually threatened a football game. And, you know, it was very interesting. I live on the north side of town, and you could watch that tornado change from looking black to looking white over the space of just a couple minutes, simply because of the direction of the path and where it was relative to the sun. You know, the motions in the tornado are spectacular. I think everybody has looked at clouds floating by, and so you're used to seeing that kind of motion in the sky. You know, when you watch a tornado, you're seeing clouds like form in the space of a second and go straight up, and then vanish in the space of a half a second, and you're seeing tentacles coming out the sides and just incredibly rapid motion both upwards and sideways around a tornado. I mean, I used to tell my students that, and they, I think, thought this was kind of funny, the first thing I would think of when I saw a tornado was God, just because I thought when you're seeing what it's doing, you realize it's something we can't make something that looks like this. And so it's just, you know, from that respect, it was, you know, pointing you to the supernatural.
Bill Gallus, do you think that this tragedy, the death of these three professional storm chasers, including your friend Tim Samaras, will cause, or perhaps already has caused, to your knowledge, a rethink in storm chasing business, whether it's worth the risks?
I know many other people who survived that tornado but almost ran into big problems the way Tim did, or at least temporarily stopping just because it was such a frightening experience. You know, my hope would be that people would start to keep a little bit more distance between themselves and the tornado. You know, I think this reinforces that we always knew that we didn't understand 100% what was going on once the tornado touched down. But I think, you know, this particular event really reinforces that. And I believe it will make people somewhat more cautious, at least smart people.
Mm-hmm. You talked about some of the questions, the open questions about tornadoes a little bit before. I wonder if there are some other ones that you and other atmospheric researchers are really curious about.
You know, so one of the I alluded to earlier, we don't know why one spinning storm will make a tornado and the other spinning storm won't. There's been some data, and it was, you know, taken in research projects recently that required basically storm chasing, you know, that suggests you get a downdraft comes down, like a river of air plunges toward the ground in a thunderstorm, and if that river of air is kind of warm, you tend to get a large tornado that lasts a long time. If that river of air is relatively cold, then you don't. You might have a very brief touchdown of a fairly weak tornado. And so, mm-hmm. You know, I think we're still trying to figure out why would this downdraft be warm in some storms and why would it be cold in others? It would seem like something like that might be something that we can figure out, and then we may have enough data that we could actually do a better job of stressing to people, you know, the true potential of having serious tornadoes on a given day.
I wonder if the loss of your friend and colleague, Tim Samaras, has changed you at all, the way that you will approach your study of violent storms in the future.
That's a tough question. You know, part of me almost feels mad.
Mad?
Mad at tornadoes. You know, I mean, I'm still fascinated by them, but, you know, part of me just kind of has lost the desire to see one for a while.
Understandable.
Right, you know, that's just sort of the personal hurt of losing a friend. But another part of me knows, you know, that, I mean, Tim's passion was to understand what's going on. And so I, you know, I've done a lot of things this week that have been kind of hard to do, that I want to, because I keep thinking, you know, he would have wanted us to keep studying the tornadoes. You know, he understood, I think, the thrill of seeing a tornado. And so I really don't think he would want to see, you know, all of the research that is being done, and the people chasing tornadoes. I don't think he would have wanted that to stop. You know, I think he was always very safety-minded, as I mentioned. There were several years that we were paying him through a grant to provide us with some tornado data, and he ended up really not being able to collect any of the data we wanted at the end of the year. And we had known he was very close to some tornadoes, so we had assumed he had had successes. But it turns out, you know, he told us that the escape route would have involved a dirt road, and there were some curtains of rain approaching, and he knew that when rain falls on a dirt road, it becomes very slippery and dangerous. And so he, you know, he said, I make no apologies for, you know, aborting the mission, because safety had to come first. So, you know, I think he would want the research to continue. You know, I think he would just want other people to share the concern he had about trying to be as safe as possible in all circumstances.
Okay, Bill Callis, thank you for joining us in this half hour, professor in Iowa State University's Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences. Thanks again, Bill. You take care.
Sure, thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to our website, iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks, and you can contact us anytime with your comments and questions. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. Once again, that's rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.